Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 131 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is a wonderful singer of jazz, pop, blues, folk, and pretty much anything else, Madeline Peru. Her most recent album, Anthem, came out in 2018. Has anything changed in the 6 years since then? Only everything. Peru's feelings and thoughts about this new kind of post-pandemic world are reflected in her ninth studio album, Let's Walk, coming out June 28th. As she expresses in this especially candid conversation, she is still struggling and creating art to get through it. She is on tour right now, doing, as she puts it, the only job she's ever had. Having previously made other writers' works her own, Peru, for the first time, has co-written all of the songs on Let's Walk. In the new single, Please Come On Inside, you can hear her keen sense of empathy and determination to be strong in a mean old man's world.
I know you're lonesome.
Peru has exhibited much strength and a striking talent throughout a career that began on the streets of Paris. She busked there as a teenager after her mother and she moved there in the late 1980s. She tells of her itinerant youth, the role that the 1939 movie musical Gulliver's Travels played in her early development, and how, in Paris, she started performing with the Lost Wandering Blues and Jazz Band. Atlantic Records discovered her, and her debut album for the label, Dreamland, came out in 1996. It earned her comparisons with Billie Holiday, which, Peru explains, was no accident. Nor was her connection with blues singer Bessie Smith.
And I wasn't nothing but a child.
8 years passed before her second solo album, Careless Love, was released on the Rounder label. This was the breakthrough, kicking off with her much-played interpretation of Leonard Cohen's Dance Me to the End of Love.
Dance me to your beauty with a burning violin.
It also includes songs by Elliott Smith, Bob Dylan, Hank Williams, and the traditional title track, which Bessie Smith popularized. Larry Klein, who had worked extensively with Joni Mitchell and others, produced that album and several that followed, including Half the Perfect World, Bare Bones, The Blue Room, and Anthem. Peru herself produced Secular Hymns, a 2016 stripped-down set of covers recorded live in an English church. How does she choose which songs to cover? Why is she writing more now? How do she and co-writer guitarist John Harrington collaborate? Is the new song Me and the Mosquito a true story? How does she feel about her role as a musician in this world? Does she appreciate performing live more now that she was prevented from doing so for a few years? Does she think of herself as a jazz or blues or folk or Americana singer? When we spoke, Peru is days away from turning 50. Is she a good birthday person? Does she feel better as she gets older? She's got a warm, fantastic voice, whether singing or talking. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Madeline Peru.
Smile, and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shine through.
Where are you talking to me from?
I'm in Brooklyn. Where are you?
I'm in Evanston, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. So,
Space, the venue. I think it's called Space.
Or? Yeah, I could walk to it. It's great.
Oh, what a wonderful part of the world. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love Space.
Beautiful.
And so here you are. You have a new album coming out, Let's Walk, which I'm really enjoying, by the way. And it covers a lot of ground, which we will talk about. And it's been 6 years since your previous album, which was Anthem. I don't know, anything with you or the world change in those 6 years?
Yeah, everything. I mean, only just what we've all witnessed as people that are alive now. You know, starting with 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic and the shutdown of in-person gatherings around the world, especially in the United States and Europe, and touring music, you know, venues having to stop working for so long, for at least you know, almost two calendar years for a lot of people. And then the psychological effect that it has on individual people and group societies to be forced to listen to their own thoughts for those two years and what kind of people emerged from that time. For me, it translated into the songs that I wrote, you know, on this record. But the world hasn't gotten, it's not like emerging from a pandemic has gone back to sort of, there's no going back, there's no going home.
Right.
After that.
We still feel like we're in a different world.
Yeah. And, you know, and then immediately after, in living in America, the election cycle just like dictates so much of what you're going to be forced to hear on the airwaves, on, you know, day-to-day public media is always like dictated by the election cycle, it seems. And, you know, it's a year away, it's this year, it's 4 years away, it just keeps on going. I've noticed from being able to live overseas that it's just not that bad when it comes to having a daily life and being able to have a cultural exchange and, you know, watch the news and the different kinds of focus. It's not as bad when it comes to that, to live over in Europe.
Right.
Even though when you live in Europe, you're a lot closer to the current war in Ukraine physically. And as far as the Middle East and as far as Israel and Gaza, it's sometimes it's disappointing how little Americans are exposed to what's happening around the world. And especially, you know, it's a very specific situation to not have any journalists on the inside of Gaza that are international journalists. But all of this does feel, it feels like it's never going to stop. Like you said, like there's no going back to before. And of course, there's a lot of things that are eternal and history. If you have time to study and really like pay attention to history, maybe you have a better perspective. I'm sure a lot of people have a better perspective than I do because I'm struggling. I'm struggling right to get through this.
Well, I think a lot of us are.
Yeah.
So as an artist, this album, you're addressing what it's like to be here now, you know, maybe in a more direct way than you would say for, you know, previous albums that you've made. For one, I assume this was sort of conscious on your part. You know, I hear sort of a call for, we need compassion and empathy. And that's something that you want to put out into the world. Is that, were you sort of conscious thinking that has to be like a theme I want to address, you know, putting this out into this world right now?
I think what's different, I mean, I think compassion and empathy has already been what music is to me. And music has become, I mean, continues to like be my, it's sort of like living in New York City. I'm here again. Like I try to get out of it. And I've tried to get to see if I should get away from music and tried, you know, to see if I shouldn't be taking up these airwaves and taking up the space around here because I don't feel like an innovator. But what I find in with this record was perfecting not the concept of compassion and empathy as the message, because although I feel that is the message, I feel that music carries that message as much as humanism carries that message. And that it's everywhere in music. Music has that humanistic, religious, secular religion. But as far as the job of this record, I would say it would be trying to perfect the skill of communicating something that's already there. The experience that we're having, that I'm having, the thoughts that I'm having within the context of the struggle to understand and to respond, to right. respond to the inhumanity, to the lack of empathy and the lack of compassion.
So a song like How I Wish is addressing that, like, in, you know, you're living in this world where there's all this injustice and, you know, how do you exist with that, you know, and how do you move forward with that? And, you know, relate each heinous act, as you put it, you know, and your lost American soul, I think there's a line from that.
Yeah. Part of that was actually recognizing this very disappointing realization that I am part of the problem because I'm not part of the solution, and feeling helpless in that moment.
What makes you not part of the solution?
Well, I don't feel like I am.
Is that because everything just seems so big and hopeless? Or is it more that, you know, there are things that you feel like you could be doing that you're not doing?
Well, I feel what I see around me is a world that has told me that things are okay. And then I've woken up to see that for Americans, only some people are okay, and then some people are not okay in the same circumstance. The equality and the we're the best country in the world rhetoric that I grew up hearing in the 70s and 80s is really only for a small group of people in this country. And there are a lot of other people that are not enjoying that circumstance. So the realization is one of hopelessness in the sense that I don't even know what I don't know where to begin sometimes. I don't wake up in the morning going, oh, obviously today I'm going to go out and register people to vote. I know some people that are civically, you know, inclined because they have had that experience, but I don't know many. I was not trained from a young age, and so I don't feel naturally inclined to have a job that is human-sized that I can undertake and volunteer to undertake of my own, you know, without somebody helping me and telling me, here's something you can do. It's very, you know, disconcerting to be aware of problems without knowing, you know, where to even begin to deal with them. And I think that's what happened during the pandemic. I think some problems I was partially aware of, and then it just is more in your face, but I never had the time to sit and think, well, what would I do? What would I do about this? You know, I chose to be a musician because obviously you choose a job when you say, this is something that I believe in and that I think I can handle. You know, people don't take on jobs. They go, oh, I know I'm going to fail at this. You know, I mean, that's not going to work. We have to allow ourselves, you know, the self-knowledge and the questioning to be able to say, well, I don't think I could do that. You know, like I wouldn't do a good job at that. Okay. Well, what would you do? Just start there. Right. But boy, when you go through a pandemic and you left and right, you know, there's so many things happening that the answers don't add up anymore. And by the way, how much time before your next therapy session comes on?
So not knowing how to begin to deal with this, I mean, was, you know, making music the way you began to deal with it? I mean, you are dealing with it in your music and, you know, in the music that I'm listening to. I mean, obviously this is being communicated to me through that. I mean, to me, I would say that's part of the solution. But I'm wondering, when you were, you know, writing these songs, recording these songs, you know, if that was, you know, a positive experience.
No, you're right. I mean, that's what this is. This is these songs, and certainly writing them and recording them, and now suddenly being able to perform them live. That is part of the response. It's part of my attempt to find something that I believe I know how to do.
It's a job you're really good at.
It's the only job I've ever had.
Well, it's a good one. And also, this is an album, because often you've interpreted other people's songs. This album is all your songs. You co-wrote them with John Harrington. How does that work? Where do the songs start? What is the process on that? How do you work them out?
John Harrington, you probably know, is a guitar player and sort of musical director in Steely Dan, and has been doing that since a record they probably in the year 2001 or some around that time, around 2000, when they made, I think it was called Two Against Nature. So, and then I met John Harrington. I actually don't remember why, but I did go and hear him perform with Steely Dan and was struck by him and, you know, his musicianship. And he started playing with me when he was not on the road with Steely Dan back in 2006. So we've been working together for, 18 years or something now. We've gotten to know each other, and I just started sending him sort of beginnings of songs during 2020. And I've co-written with other people, and I had been trying to collaborate with some other people, but John Harrington is really... He's a singular human being. He's very open-minded. And that's not enough to describe John, but I will say that for the purposes of my writing songs with him that day, he was the only person that always came back with, oh, yes, and, instead of,
right,
I don't know what to do with this. So we started co-writing quite naturally, via the internet. And I think it was, we were both enjoying it so much, we decided to make demos of three of the songs, which then we sent around to some people and said, hey, this is what I'm working on. A company called 30 Tigers simultaneously was talking to me about making another record. And so I sent them these demos, and they said, great, let's do it. And let's do it now. And I took another year of writing, actually met with Elliot Shiner, who was also, had also worked with John Harrington with Steely Dan. But of course, Elliot Shiner is a very important engineer, who's one of the top 10 most, you know, engineers of the 20th century in pop music. And as far as I know, he's been on almost everything. And he met with us, kindly said he would like to, Elliot basically said to me, Madeline Prue, I wondered why we haven't worked together. And that was a very nice way to put the whole thing. Anyway, lots of different connections. We met together, and then Elliot said, well, I like the three songs you wrote, so I don't like any of the other ideas for songs. So keep writing, because I thought we were going to do a bunch of covers.
Oh, so you send him some covers and the originals, and he's like, yeah, I like the originals, I don't like the covers.
Right. And he kind of put his foot down with us. And so I suddenly had to write more. And it really spent another year writing after that. And that's why it took from basically 2020 through the end of 2023. And we just finished making it in August. It will be released in June. Finish making it. We finished, yeah.
Right. Did you guys book studio time and all get together and record it in the old fashioned way? Or was this one of these where people are either tracks flying around on email and stuff?
It was pretty old fashioned, actually. For various reasons, I suppose it was the only way that I could make sense of our budget. And of course, Elliot Shiner's desire to do tracking with a particular type of board and a particular type of studio also limited that. And so we actually recorded everything in 3 days in a place called the Clubhouse in upstate New York. We added a fourth day to record the amazing background vocalists, three singers, came up
on Let's
to the
Walk.
Same room. Yeah, and a handful of other songs right. as well, yeah.
When you're writing these songs, so you're coming up with the beginnings, do you sit with like a, you know, guitar and do you start plunking out musical ideas and then start singing over them? Or do you have like a pen in hand with a piece of paper and you're writing out lyrics and then you think, okay, I got to put this to music? Like, how does that all work?
Well, it's pretty mixed up. I can tell you, I can, because I'm at home, I can remember coming up with the idea for the French song while I was doing the dishes. And it had to do with the actual sound of the words, mon petit appart à Paris, which means my little apartment in Paris. And this idea that there's an attitude behind those lyrics because, so I have an apartment in Paris, you know, what's the big deal? Everything's fine, just nonchalant. You know, it's my little apartment in Paris, mon petit appart à Paris. And I just thought it's so funny how that sounds so cute and French or whatever. And it is sort of, it reminded me of this reality that I remember a friend of mine saying, you know, he said, you know, their parents buy them an apartment. That's a lot of French people, their parents buy them an apartment. And I thought, what? Their parents bought them an apartment? But they do. And just like in America, oh, the parents bought them a car or bought them a college, you know, a 4-year private school. It's very expected in this type of bourgeois culture where we have the resources for something like that to just gift this huge financial thing to a child. And then there are, of course, a lot of kids who don't ever expect that because they know that the money is not there. And I certainly did not expect anything of the kind as a child. But now my mother has a little apartment in Paris.
Nice.
I'm older though. Yeah. So I kind of live in the in-between place where I feel like I did grow up without a sort of bourgeois level of money in the family, in the home. But I'm no longer, now I have, I guess, I don't know what I am. I'm bourgeois now when it comes to money.
So, yeah. and you moved, what I had read at least, is that you'd moved to Paris when you were 13 with your mother. So has she been there the whole time?
No, my mother had been to France when she was a young child because her father was there during the Second World War, had made a friend with a French translator. And when he came back from the war and was having a lot of mental breakdown type of, you know, episodes, he wanted my mother, who was an only child at the time, to go and stay with his friend in France. And he sent her by herself on an airplane in the 1951 or something to go and live with this French family. And she didn't speak a lick of French, but she ended up learning French because of that. And she became a French language teacher. She became French, you know, French major, French literature major. She became an academic. She then eventually met my father, who had a New Orleans French name, Peru. I think that she suffered a lot just to get that name, but he was also very attractive. When she met him, he was doing a Molière play in the university as the theater teacher, drama director. And they had a great romance, a tumultuous romance. And of course she stayed with him for quite a long time. And they had two of us. So I and my younger brother resulted from that. And then my father basically lost his job teaching and didn't work after that. So he just sort of sat around, if I may. He kind of resembled the guy in the song by, who's the guy that did King Tut with the, he's got these white
Steve
hair.
Martin?
Yeah. So Steve Martin wrote a song called Atheists Don't Have No Songs. And that's my father. The guy in that song is my dad. He sits around in his underwear watching football. Yeah, well, he sits around watching football in his underpants on Sundays anyway. So whatever. That's That was my father when I was growing up. They eventually split up and my mother got a job. Well, she was supporting the family, but she was offered a job from the Bank of New York to go to Paris. And so we all moved to Paris because of my mother being such a Francophile. That's the truth.
Well, you were born in Athens, Georgia, I read, but it doesn't sound like you were around there long enough to suck up the music scene, because then it looks like you moved around a lot before you even got to Paris.
Yes, we did. And really, the music scene that I grew up with was my parents' records. You know, I didn't experience Athens, Georgia, or New Orleans, or Portland, or L.A., and even when I came to New York, I was a kid in South Brooklyn. There was no real music scene, just the radio. So what I did was I learned from this sort of eclectic record collection that we had with, you know, Edith Piaf and French-Canadian artists from my mother. And then my father had New Orleans and Texas swing records like Hank Williams. And there was all the sort of hippie records. I don't know if they are technically very hippie, but, you know, Jim Croce, Peter, Paul and Mary. That's how I heard all this different American music until I went to France.
And then
when I went to France, I met Americans and I started learning blues and more obscure stuff than I had ever heard before. Like stuff you don't hear on the oldies radio stations. You can't.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people go to France and discover jazz, I guess. But you started busking in Paris. Were you with French musicians then or other expat Americans?
Americans. Yeah. Americans. Yeah. But there were a bunch of different people. There was a Dutch guitar player that was going to the Jazz Conservatory in South Holland. There was a French guitar player who, for some reason, just loved to play jazz. I don't know where that came from. There were people from all over Europe, actually, in that neighborhood that we would all meet at this cafe called the Café Mazé in the Latin Quarter. And we'd bring all these coins in and the cafe owner would let us exchange the coins for bills, knowing full well that we would all end up buying a beer or two or three and hang out and play songs. And there was something very magical around that cafe.
Do you remember like the first songs you ever loved?
Songs that I still know. I know them because I'll always know them. And so some of the first songs that I ever like started memorizing were actually from a cartoon called Gulliver's Travels. That was from the year, I think it's 1939, the year of The Wizard of Oz. But the whole soundtrack was written by these two Tin Pan Alley guys that wrote a bunch of other songs. Well, you know, Vera Lynn, she sang some of their songs. Let's see. I Hear a Dream is the one that I remember. Come Home Again. It was the one that Gulliver sings when he's sitting on the beach.
No apologies.
I hear a dream all day, a dream that calls to me. Come home again, you sailor man, home again to the sea. Okay, lyrics by Leo Robin and music by Ralph Ranger, R-A-I-N-G-E-R. And Ralph Ranger, if you look him up, also wrote Easy Living. You remember Easy Living, if you know jazz standards?
Yeah.
Living for you is easy living. Well, it's one of the first songs I had to learn, Easy Living.
Is this the sort of stuff you were busking? Like, what were you singing on the streets, and did you enjoy that?
Well, it was that kind of stuff, because the irony was that I had heard, like, the Fats Waller, Easy Living, I didn't know, but, like, Your Feet's Too Big and Ray Charles and a lot of these songs that were standards that were covered by a lot of different people. I had heard them over and over. And then I came to Paris and I heard these expats that were about my age who were doing these same songs. And I thought, no, but not my age at the time. They're my age now. And I thought, that's the wrong lyric. And I went up and told them so. And they said, oh, really? Oh, interesting. You can pass the hat for us. That's what happened.
Nice. So how did you get discovered, quote unquote?
So eventually I joined a band in Paris called the Lost Wandering Blues and Jazz Band. And somebody who started to make a movie about us, is a college student, a film student, was making a documentary about us. And he said, listen, you guys need to go to Harlem because a lot of this music comes from Harlem. You need to go and play in Harlem. And we said, that's this crazy idea. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. That's not how this works. And so the band leader, Danny Fitzgerald, said, okay. And we did. We came back to New York. We spent a couple weeks here, I guess, in 1990 or something. And we played our songs all over the place. And somebody from Atlantic Records, whose name was Yves Beauvais, apparently a French person, but no connection really necessarily, he saw us perform and he came up to me he started coming to our shows at these little clubs around New York wherever we could get a little gig. And he came up to me at the end of the night at a place called a rodeo bar. And it was just a place on the corner that had peanut shells all over the floor, but there was an actual stage. And they had like $2 frozen margarita mix that really, I don't know how on earth I did it, but I used to drink that stuff. Anyway, Yves Beauvais comes up to me and says, I'm from Atlantic Records. I said, okay. And he says, well, you know, we'd be interested in working with you, making a record with you or something like that. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about, but I got to go home tomorrow. I got to fly back home to Paris. I don't live here. And that's it. And I was 16 or 17 at the time. And I literally looked straight down the barrel of what he was talking about in the music business. And I thought, I don't want to do that. That's horrible. That sounds horrible. Why would I do that?
So when you were singing, you weren't thinking, oh, I want to do this to have a career like that.
No, I always thought that it wouldn't amount to anything and that I would have to go back to school eventually and have to get a job eventually. And that was the way I understood my life. And it took me so long to just accept this incredible gift, you know. Even after I'd made a record with Eve, I still had doubts for years, you know, whether I'm an imposter or not, it's too late, you know, like I'm not going to go anywhere now. It's too late. I'm tired.
Early on, I know there were a lot of people comparing you. They say, oh, it's like Billie Holiday or, you know, Ella Fitzgerald or Edith Piaf or whatever. The Billie Holiday thing seems like it was the most. When you would hear that, did you think, oh, that's really great? Or did you think it was annoying? Or like, how do you like being compared to these legendary singers at that time?
It was normal to say that I sounded like Billie Holiday because I literally listened and mimicked Billie Holiday, listened to the way she did things and said, well, this is the best way to do this. And it was the only way that I could become a singer also, because, you know, that she pioneered this style of not singing, but speech singing, really, in many ways, before anybody else did. You know, I really think she innovated the style of minimalism in vocal jazz. And I don't think anybody has really, you know, been able to perfect that. I mean, Shirley Horn, I think to some extent is in the same school. But Billie Holiday is even less, you know, singerly, if I may say. You know, there's not a lot of long projected notes. And when there are, it feels very effortless and in the technique side of things. Obviously, there's a lot of study and or intuitive study that goes into fitting words into music and phrasing and accents and getting melodies and tone and yelping the way that she does and just so many details. She does so many beautiful things, very rhythmic things that are quite, you know, subtle. But in the meantime, I found that is the best voice, to the most modern voice, really, to learn to sing these old songs for me.
Right.
And of course, I was also studying Bessie Smith and blues songs at the same time. I've always had a real love for a lot of early blues, and I still do. It's actually the most soothing part of my day. But that is apparently what Billy was listening to as well. So I don't know.
Yeah, and the other thing with Billie Holiday is conveying emotion, which clearly you do as well. And you're conveying your emotion, not Billie Holiday's emotion. But that seems like, you know, being able to sort of feel what the singer is feeling is a key part of the experience too, right?
Yes, like an actor. There's a theatrical, almost dramatic technique involved, I feel, more with Billie Holiday than anybody else. And I came from sort of a theatrical family, with my father being a drama teacher. And I think I was naturally drawn to that type of, you know, is theatrical the right word for it? I mean, she embodies the character of the person that's singing. It's a lot harder. Now, when it comes down to like singing a tisk at a tasket, I had just really struggle with that. Like, why would anybody want to sing that? You know, because there's no backstory. Who's a tisk at a tasket? You know, what am I supposed to feel here? You know, I mean, that's kind of how I approached everything at the beginning. But Danny Fitzgerald, who is the leader of the Lost Wandering Blues and Jazz Band, you know, he knew exactly how to portray a story, how to tell a story. And I was 16 years old, and he said, you go and sit in the car and learn this song called Was I Drunk? Was He Handsome? And Did Mama Give Me Hell? And I said, I hate this song. He said, you go and learn that song. And until you do, you're staying in the car.
Wow.
And it was on my first record with Atlantic Records, because it was one of my songs that I did. And everybody loved it to this day. And I've heard some other people cover it since. And I'm like, yeah, that's really fun. That's really funny and cool and whatever it is. So it's all about your approach, right? It's all about your perspective.
Was there anything you did to get yourself around on that song?
I enjoyed the phrasing, and I ignored the words that, you know, you look past the details a little bit. You go, okay, this is close to home. I'm 16. I drink a lot. I'm, you know, experimenting with boys or sexual encounters. I don't want to be saying this directly in the song. It's too real. You know, this is humiliating. But if you go da 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 da, oh, and learn those chords and hear that those changes. Da 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 da. Oh, I know what chord that. Okay. Da, 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 da. And then you feel the pulse and the rhythm, and you're like, okay, we're telling a story. Okay. And yeah, I guess it's an ego thing. You know, it was good for me, because I said, okay, fine. I got to do what I got to do. But yeah, I don't sing it anymore, though.
It's not still in your set? You're not doing it on this tour?
It probably would be hard to fake that I was still 16.
Well, you've got a big birthday coming up, if Wikipedia is correct.
It's true. Thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. I've always been waiting to get older. which is probably, you know, not the only way to go about life, but that's me. That's how I've been. It's going to be so much better when I'm older and I have more freedom or more understanding or more, you know, I'll be able to do things the way I want, or I just won't feel so awkward anymore. Whatever it is, you know, I'll be older. It's going to be better.
So you feel that way now? So, does it work? Did it work?
I do enjoy it though. Obviously I don't think I really managed to do childhood on this go round in life, but I'm enjoying this. I'm enjoying the capacity of the brain to develop to a point where you see concepts and big pictures and you can read the same book 20 years later and go, that's not at all the way I remember it. You know, it's like a different. Yeah. So I appreciate that. I appreciate I appreciate the solidarity that I've been able to build with musicians that when I was a kid, I thought, oh, I'm going to be a musician. One of the reasons is I know I'm going to work with musicians. And a musician, how bad can a person be if they care about music? That was literally like a very clear, logical point for me. And it turns out I've done okay that way. So yeah. I'm really lucky. Yeah.
Do you feel sort of a restlessness of moving forward? Like I know what I'm doing now. I don't have to like reinvent myself.
I think a lot of musicians are trying to reinvent themselves. I think that my particular path has taken me into songwriting right now. But I am trying to do my very best at singing these songs live. And so far I've had a really good experience and I look forward to that. So, you know, once you look at what a song is and then if the song is good, then you can just do whatever you want. Right. Because I've been singing other people's songs. So if I've written a good song, then I'm going to feel really, really satisfied with that. It doesn't mean that I would try to stop doing that.
You were known early on as a jazz singer. And I think if they were categorizing you now, it's like, well, you're jazz and pop and folk and blues and Americana, whatever that is, the Great American Songbook. And like, it's all those things, right? Like, would you put yourself in any kind of singer box at this point?
Yeah, as a singer, if people ask me, I go back to what I feel like I come from, which is blues and jazz and some folk. That's what I come from. But those terms are loose for me because it's not particularly a certain, there's so many ways to talk about blues. Some people think that blues is only from Chicago and there's a lot of excellent music that came out of Chicago, but it's not the same music necessarily that you hear coming out of the Delta on the other side of the Mississippi or Piedmont, you know, out in the Appalachian area. Or there's, of course, the racial separation at that time. So you had some music that sounds like blues, but it's white bluegrass, you know, or black music that sounds more like country, or, you know, and those things are all mixed up and they always have been. If America could just catch up with its own culture and just live up to its own standards, just catch up with what's already there. Just look at what we already have. We've created so many wonderful, amazing things. Just to try to stop and breathe and appreciate it. It's hard to do. I understand. But instead, we're going nuts.
Well, you've covered a lot of that ground, again, in your recordings. I mean, and you've worked with New Orleans musicians and Alan Toussaint. And I mean, you look at the album by album, the musicians you've worked with and the songs you've covered, whether it's, again, Randy Newman or co-writing with Bill Wyman of the Stones, or, I mean, like, you've done.
No, I don't deserve any of the things that I've done. Yeah. But I've done them despite myself. And the thing is,
why would you say that?
That's America.
That's crazy. Don't say that.
Well, none of these things, like if you were to describe me as the person that did all these things, you'd think that I'd have all this authority over music. I didn't. I was just there at that time, place and time, you know?
I think it's more just being present for what music is and represents, and being aware of that, you know, what you're doing encompasses Billie Holiday and Randy Newman and, you know, all of these other, and your own original stuff that you're doing too.
Yeah, that's America. That's a positive image you're painting of this music that we all get to partake in, and the fact that it can all be in one pot, you know, that Billie Holiday and Randy Newman, what do they have in common exactly? You know, I think it's a lot, but it's not obvious. They're very different.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Now that the weather is heating up, Revolution's premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, and a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Sing music differently now than, I don't know, 20 years ago? Yeah, 20 years ago, what about Careless Love? This will be the 20th anniversary this year. Like, what's, how do you approach things differently now than then?
I don't know that I can really say that I'm different. I'm just older and I have more awareness and, you know, my priorities are clearer, you know? Like, I know that I care more, I care less about paying the rent because I don't have as much concern for getting through, you know, paying, getting a, making sure I make the monthly amount, because I've worked on that already. I know that the kids that are in my family that I used to worry about are grown up, you know, I've survived. That's all. That's changed. I appreciate being able to say I did it. I'm 50. That's it. You know, I'm just grateful.
Would you say getting back on stage, if that's sort of like a happy place for you to be as opposed to a fraught place? I mean, you know, obviously there was like this long period where, you know, you couldn't go back on stage. So like, what is it like getting back on stage now?
It's great. And I appreciate it more even than I used to. I mean, as somebody who played with street bands for a while, there's always this sort of conceit that, well, I know how to do it without the theater and without all the production value, and we can always go back to that. But that's the utopian ideal, I think, is that there's always free music available. High quality art is available for free everywhere all the time. But failing that, living back here in reality, you know, it's wonderful to have a dedicated space and time to be together with strangers in a room, with the opportunity for an intimate exchange of something like a sound, the human voice, or any other instrument. And you know, I think it's essential. You know, I give it more meaning than I did before. I'm sorry if I sound really corny.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
I think it's really important, you know.
I was going to ask you about the song Me and the Mosquito, which is a very funny song. You're covering a lot of weighty issues on this album, and then there's a mosquito. And I love attention and acceptance. I'm human after all. So I'm like, all right, so you're starting off with like basic existence, and then you're getting Make Me Incognito, and it's Me and the Mosquito. Were you just like getting really pissed off at a mosquito that was buzzing around you?
Yes. John Harrington and I were again trying to fill the quota. We were trying to write for this record, and we were in the dark because everything was so organic. It just, some of these songs came to me in my sleep, you know, overnight, and I would wake up like Let's Walk. I woke up with the lyrics, you know, fully formed, and I had no idea how the song would work, but that's the way that I had constructed the sentences. I was talking to John, and of course we had a similar story. It was summer in New York City, which is humid. And there was this one, you know, we all have our screens closed down on the windows and everything. And there's this one mosquito that got in my room last night, and I had to stay up all night. I had to turn the lights on and like seek it out and find it. I couldn't see it. And it was, I would still hear it. Every time I would stop looking for it, it would go, you know. And he said, yeah, me too. I lost so much sleep last night. I said, oh, John, I really hate mosquitoes. I mean, I've had experiences when I was a kid where there were blood stains on the wall because there was an infestation in the building and the apartment building. I was just so, you know, I just have this thing where I just don't care for them. And he said, well, you should write a song about it. I was like, oh, well, I don't know about that, John. What do you mean? Like a variety, a funny song. What's that called? A
novelty song?
Sort of a novelty song. Thank you. But I have no idea. I've never tried to write a song like that before. There's no way. I said, John, I don't think it's a good idea. He's like, well, try it. You sound really funny when you're talking about it. I said, okay, just try it. And I said, let's check out Hank Williams' Fly Trouble, because it to me is one of the greatest examples of that I know. And we listened to that, and then I immediately, and John goes, oh, that's so great. And I said, yeah, it's great. And I said, now I feel less like I should ever be able to write this song. It's too hard. It's like, that's so good. He writes, half of it is him speaking, and then he has a chorus. Buzz, buzz, buzz goes that list, pesky little fly. Buzz, 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 da, 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 da. And I just said, yeah, it's so swinging. It's so good. So anyway, you know, I don't know what happened, but one day I just said, oh, I had a breakthrough. And I live in a neighborhood where I get to hear a lot of, well, there's a lot of forced listening. Let's put it that way. In my neighborhood in Brooklyn and New York, you know, whether there's a Chinatown in Brooklyn nearby, and there's also very Central South American, I don't know what you call it, because it's people from everywhere. It's not just, it used to be Puerto Rican, but now it's like, there's a lot of Mexican music, real authentic old folk Mexican music. There's quinceañeras in the park across the street almost every weekend. And you'll hear like live, you know, performers doing these amazing operatic folk songs. And I hear it all the time. So I think that's what got me to put a form together. And anyway.
Well, it's fun. It cracked me up.
Hence the song. And I thought it was interesting that, yeah.
Well, look, sometimes we worry about the big things. Sometimes we just want to get that mosquito out of our lives. So
I'm telling you. And then there was an article in the paper that said scientists are now capable of totally, by genetic mutation or genetic manipulation, are capable of totally eradicating mosquitoes from the planet. And it's very tempting. Some people do say, though, it's probably not a good idea. You know,
there's probably some Jurassic Park like scenario where having gotten rid of the mosquitoes, like the dinosaurs come back and eat everyone because of the law of unintended consequences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly right. And so I almost wrote the song with sort of the desire to make it clear that, you know, we really shouldn't do this.
Well, it was just, it's me and the mosquito, not me and all mosquitoes.
No, you're right. You're right.
So you've made the distinction.
It's just me and that one mosquito.
Nobody's going to fault you for dispatching that one mosquito.
No. Well, if they fault me, it's too bad, because
the mosquito's
gone. I draw the line.
Yeah.
I draw the line with that one mosquito during that song. it dies at the end.
Right. You, there's a little hand clap at the end. That was that song cracked me up. I thought it was really fun. And thank you. It was wonderful.
No regrets.
No regrets and no apologies. Great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
That's all for episode 131 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Madeline Peru for opening up about her inspiration, struggles, and talents as an artist. Her new album, Let's Walk, comes out June 28th on 30 Tigers. The latest single, Showman Dan, is on YouTube now. And you can find more information about the album and her tour at madelineperu.com. She is performing April 26th at the Englert Theater in Iowa City, April 27th and 28th at City Winery Chicago, with dates to follow in Kent and Columbus, Ohio, in Maryland, Virginia, and Connecticut, and two nights at New York's Sony Hall on May 10th and 11th. Follow Madeline Peru, one word, on Instagram and at mperumusic on Twitter. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who turns everything he touches into a dreamland.
Chris, I'm sorry. That's my first thing I want to say to Chris.
Thanks to Gary Kretschmer for becoming a Carol Pop friend. You can too for a mere $24. Please contribute at carolpop.com and help keep this thing going. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.